story, because it leads into basically what our solution is. Roland Hazard was a man that lived right around this area, and they would summer. He would summer together with Ebbie Thatcher and Bill Wilson. So they knew each other, and it's kind of amazing how the drama played itself out. I'm not going to get in really involved with the details, but they all knew each other, and they all had serious drinking problems. Basically, Roland Hazard was a very moneyed person. His family had a lot of money, and when alcoholism started getting his attention, he could go to the absolute best because he could afford it. So the story is that he went over to Europe and began being treated by Carl Jung. Carl Jung was probably the best there was at that time, and it's very lucky for us that he believed in spiritual solutions. A lot of the psychiatrists at that time did not, and he was one of them that did. And he underwent about a year's worth of treatment with Jung, and on his way home, back to America, I don't even think he was able to get past Paris before he got drunk. So a whole year, and I can't even imagine how much money getting treated by the tops in the psychiatric community, he didn't last very long out on his own. He went back to Jung and he said, come on, man, tell me what's wrong. I mean, this is nuts. I got drunk before I got to Paris. And Carl Jung talked to him, and basically he begged the doctor, and the doctor finally told him that he believed that he was hopeless. He was hopeless apart from divine help. And I'm just going to read a paragraph here that kind of describes what he's talking about. Imagine poor Roland. He just spent like 10 grand or something on treatment. And he's asking, am I really going to die? Because the doctor is saying, unless you're locked up or hire a bodyguard, you may not make it. He says, well, is there any exceptions? And here's what Carl Jung says. He says, exceptions to such cases as yours have been occurring since the early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once guiding forces in the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to do that in you. So basically, a personality change at depth is what he was looking for, and he was not able to do it with the psychiatric treatments of that time. And I don't believe they can do it today with the psychiatric treatments that they give you. He said, you know what you should probably do, pal? You should probably go home and get involved in like an evangelical religious organization or something, Go with the rollers. Otherwise you may not survive. Well, at that period of time, there was what was known as the Oxford Group, and Roland Hazard got involved with the Oxford Group. He got sober. One of his friends was Ebbie Thatcher from this area. Ebbie got into some trouble. Instead of going to jail, Roland Hazard grabbed him away from the judge and said, I'll take him to New York. I'll enroll him in the Oxford Group. Took him to New York. One of Ebbie Thatcher's buddies, it was rumored, was drinking themselves to death in New York. So Ebbie Thatcher went to pay a visit on Bill Wilson. And this is kind of the web of events that brought to Bill Wilson the answer to his problem. Remember, he knew the first drink got him drunk, but he didn't know how not to pick up the first drink. Well, this is one of the things that Ebbie Thatcher brought to him. He brought to him a solution, a spiritual solution, and it was a very religious solution at that time. In the early Oxford Group, it was very much an evangelical type of group, and they believed very much in following a lot of religious principles. But I'll tell you what, the fundamentals of the Oxford Group are really what the fundamentals of Alcoholics Anonymous are today. And the solution was the same then as it is now. And it talks a little bit on page 29. Clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. and there'll be 43 personal experiences afterward. So each recovery may be unique in certain aspects, but the fundamentals of recovery are the same. There are certain spiritual exercises that can be followed that can bring about a spiritual experience, and this is kind of what we're going to be moving into rather quickly this morning.
There's one thing that comes up from on page 26:1, the last third of that paragraph. It says, above all, he believed he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind that the hidden springs, that relapse was unthinkable. Well, put that in terms of your own sobriety. You know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years sober, do you think you know enough about AA that you're not going to get drunk? You know, have you ever said to yourself, oh, I can go to that party, I know I won't get drunk there. You know, well, where is the problem center? We learn the problem center is in our mind, you know, and we can't differentiate the true from the false. You know, once again, we're behind enemy lines. That paragraph that Chris just read on page 29:2, kind of interesting. They're describing what we're supposed to do when we tell our stories. You know, each individual in the person of the story is described in his own language and from his own point of view, the way he established his relationship with God. The next time you're at a speaker's meeting, listen for it. I mean, how many times do you get up there? The speaker says, drunkalog, 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 drunkalog. That's all you hear is drunkalog. What is he supposed to be sharing? The way he established his relationship with God. That paragraph changed my life. I go to an AA meeting. When I speak at an AA meeting, I give you enough information so that you can identify with me, to know that I am an alcoholic like you, like we read in that paragraph on page 12. And then I bring you right to AA. And then I came to AA, and I will talk the rest of the time about what God is doing in my life and how I work the 12 steps and the spiritual experiences I'm having and right down the line, soup to nuts, because that's what this book tells us. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers on page 222. We did not tell our drinking histories at meetings back then. We did not need to. A man's sponsor and Dr. Bob knew the details. Frankly, we did not think it was anybody's business. Besides, we already knew how to drink. What we really wanted to learn was how to get sober and stay sober. We still didn't care for it when people would get carried away by their own voices and make their stories too sensational. If you speak more than 15 minutes, you're probably going to repeat yourself. And no souls are saved after 15 minutes. Whoa. Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, 264. He, Dr. Bob, said there were two ways to break anonymity at the anonymity tradition. One was by giving your name at the public level of press, radio, or film. Two, by being so anonymous that you can't be reached by other drunks. The AA who hides his identity from his fellow AA by using only his given name violates the tradition just as much as the AA who permits his name to appear in the press in connection with matters pertaining to AA. Here's my experience. I was hurting. I knew a guy that I'd been talking to. I knew he had a common experience, and I called him up. The only phone number I had for him was his work number. His name was Mike, and he's an attorney. I called up, and I said, I need to speak to Mike. And they said, what is this in reference to? And I said, it's personal. And they said, which Mike? There's three Mikes. And I started to describe Mike over the telephone. Well, he's about this high, and you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. And she goes, well, that describes two Mikes. I need to know more. How do you know Mike? And now I'm faced with breaking the man's anonymity. I had to hang up, you know. I went and found out that guy's anonymity. I found out what his last name was. The next time I called him, I was able to share it. When I got sober, I understand the need for anonymity. I didn't want anybody to know that I came to AA. I never told anybody, including my parents. And the next thing you know, I'm getting cards from aunts and uncles I haven't seen in 20 years. Congratulations, we're so happy that you finally got some help. You know, we've been praying for you for 15 years. I never told them. And it was one of my first resentments in AA. People broke my anonymity. Now it's more important for people to know my last name so they know how to get a hold of me. They know where I am. You know, I don't worry about it anymore because I'm on the basis of trusting and relying upon my concept of a higher power. If I'm supposed to have some repercussions from it, I'll have it. If I'm not, I'm not. So I don't worry that people know my last name. You know, most people call me Pilot Dave. You know, I'm known everywhere as Pilot Dave, and that works in most places, you know. But when I get somebody's phone number, I take their name and I ask them for their last name, so I know, you know. And I can call up and ask for John Smith instead of just saying any John. You know, he's 23 years old, he's 6'2" and 280 pounds. Anyway, enough of that. Where are we? Page 30. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we are alcoholics. No person likes to admit that he's bodily mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control his and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. Now, here's a question for you. Did you ever try to prove to yourself that you could drink like normal people? If you did, probably you're an abnormal drinker, because normal people don't do that. Right? The persistence of this illusion is astonishing, and many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. Wait a minute. They're telling us the first step. This is the fifth requirement. Remember those list of requirements for step one? Here's number five. We have to concede to our innermost selves. You notice they're not saying walking in the door. You see them coming to A. Oh, yeah, I know I'm alcoholic. You know, and they just kind of blow it off. Uh-uh. Not up here. We concede down here in our heart to our innermost selves that we're alcoholic. We finally realize and believe in our hearts, I'm whooped. I'm beat. You know? It is not something. Alcoholics scare me to death that go from step one to step two happy. Yeah. Happy alcoholics scare me. That is not what step one is about. Step one is about realizing that you are just out and out screwed. If you pick up a drink, you're screwed. If you put it down, you're screwed. And if you manage to stay sober for any kind of length of time, the spiritual malady is still going to be alive in you, and either way, you're screwed. Conceding is like a little kid, you know, when you're wrestling, and you're on the ground, and he's got your arm behind your back, and he's twisting it so hard that you beat on the mat, and you go, okay, I give, uncle. That is not happy. You're not saying that because you're real proud of the fact that you just lost. You know, that's what they're talking about. We don't do it happily. If you understand you're drinking, alcohol is the only thing that ever worked for me. It was my best friend, and it was my tool, and it stopped working for me. I was not happy about that. I was not happy about having to come to AA, because I had to come to AA or die. I didn't do that in a happy manner. So I make sure, what I do when I 12-step somebody, I slap him upside the head with his hopelessness. I show him the truth about what step one is about. It's about that he has a fatal disease and he's a walking dead man. And he better find a higher power, because that is the only thing that can save him. He can't do it. AA can't do it. These steps can't do it. But his relationship with his higher power can. We don't like to grab a hold of that. But when I give him that only option, he picks it up and he takes it. Because that's his only option. So conceding is really an important part of step one for us to understand. Uh, 31:3. I will take anybody up to page 31. Why? Because look what we do here. It says, we do not like to pronounce an individual as an alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. I'll take anybody up to step one, and then they get to diagnose themselves. Why is this important? Well, for one thing, doctors can't diagnose an alcoholic can slip through. The U.S. astronauts get poked and prodded by the best of the best. Best physicians, the best psychologists, psychiatrists, check those guys. Two alcoholics actively drinking have walked on the moon and are now in recovery. A doctor can't screen that stuff through. This is a self-diagnosed disease. Well, what do they say when we diagnose? They've given us a whole series of questions, and Chris is going to cover them when we do the wrap-up. But look here. It says you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Wait a minute. The big book is saying try controlled drinking? It's telling us to go out and drink? Well, if you're not convinced, do it. I can't tell you how much flack I've gotten at AA meetings when somebody's saying, well, I don't want to do this. And I look at them and I say, well, then go drink. And the old timers come up to me to grab hold of me and they go, you can't tell somebody to go drink. And I say, why not? He's not sure. What does the book say? If you're not sure, it is better to get a bad case of the jitters and know the truth about yourself than to hide out in AA and thinking and kind of sure, well, maybe have, you may kill somebody who comes in who knows he's alcoholic. But he gets a hold of you as his sponsor and you're kind of going, well, I'm not sure, you know, I love him enough not to kill him. Maybe that's what it takes, you know. Try to drink and stop abruptly. Oh, try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide. If you're honest with yourself about it, it may be worth a bad case of the jitters to get full knowledge of your condition. Dr. Bob in the Good Old Timers, page 225. Then he, Dr. Bob, told me to go down to the Mayflower Hotel. That's the same hotel that Bill had his quandary about when he met Dr. Bob. Buy a bottle of whiskey, take a couple of good drinks, and then cork the bottle. If you can stay there a couple more days without taking another drink, you don't need us. He was right. 6 months later, I was back. AA comes of age. The character of AA was changing. We were beginning to have success with milder alcoholics, even some potential alcoholics. What an unusual word. The first year, those of us who sobered up in AA had been grim, utterly hopeless cases, almost without exception, but now younger folks began to appear. Of course, it was necessary for these newcomers to hit bottom emotionally. That's what I'm talking about. Slap them with the hopelessness of this disease. Hit them in the emotional belt. They don't have to lose their house, their cars, their wives, the whole life. Hit them emotionally where it hurts, where they know the truth lies. That's enough. Slap them with the emotional bottom. But we found it did not have to hit every bottom possible. There was order to admit that they were licked. We began to develop a conscious technique of raising the bottom and hitting them with it. That's where I get that term from. Hit somebody with their bottom. You know? I like them to hurt. That's not a bad thing. I hope they hurt bad enough that they're willing to do what it takes in this program to stay sober. AA Comes of Age on page 199. In the beginning, we could not sober up women. They were different, they said. But then they saw other women get well, and they slowly followed suit. The derelict, the rich man, the socialite, or the addict, all these once thought AA was not for them. So did certain people of other races and tongues and creeds. But when they clearly saw the alcoholic tragedy for which they were headed, they could forget their differences and join AA. If I can get anything else across, I hope you realize that we are alcoholics. That is what binds us together. The fact that I'm a pilot separates us. Anybody that's not a pilot will all of a sudden chop that out. The fact that I'm an alcoholic and a something else, that's a subtle way for me to say I'm just a little bit different than you. He has 3 DWIs. I have 0. Wait a minute. That separates us. She may have drank her booze out of the laundry basket. I never did. That separates us. What binds us together? Physical craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady. The rest is all drama. So think about this concept. We all have the same bottom. Wait a minute. I thought everybody has different bottoms. No. You hear about the invisible line that you cross? That invisible loss is when line we talk about is the phenomenon of craving, where all of a sudden you can't drink normally. When you take the first drink, you don't know where it's going to end up. It may end up normal, or it may end up in Topeka with one shoe. That is our bottom. Once you've crossed into that area of craving, you're the same as every other alcoholic in the world, including the potential alcoholic, because he has craving. What's the difference? The difference is how much pain can you take? Okay, so the point I'm trying to make is, from that point on, it's how much pain can you take. We know a guy in our area. I gave him a huge resentment one time because I was doing a little thing at our home group, and I called him a recreational relapser. Because he comes in, and he gets better, and as soon as the pain wears off, he says, I don't need this stuff, and he goes back out and uses. Until the pain gets too bad, he can't take the pain anymore, and then he comes back in. AA is like a filling station, you know? I got to come in, you know, and get another tank of spirituality, you know, and then once the pain wears off, he forgets about it, and he goes back out and uses again, you know? That is, all that drama is what separates us. If I haven't had the same experience, my ego will use that and say, well, I'm a little different than her. I didn't drink out of the laundry basket. I don't need to hear what she says because I'm not that kind of alcoholic. I've just signed my death warrant. Because that person may be the person that God speaks through and gives me the jewel that I need to stay sober that day. You know, I can't afford to separate myself from anybody. And that includes the old-timer who doesn't do any step work. He may have the message for me in an AA meeting. You know, he may just have had different levels of pain. As long as we have the same 3 basic things, we both share physical craving, we both share mental obsession, and we both share spiritual malady. That guy can help save my life, and I care about him. I want to know what he's got to say. He'll change me. That's enough out of me. I'm going to let Chris go for a while.
Thanks, Dave. There's a number of examples of different types of drinkers that they were working with early on. I'm going to cover a few of them here. They talk about a guy here, Fred. A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was nervous in the morning after these bouts. He quieted himself with more liquor. He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw he would get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control, whatever. This is a guy who was able to stop. At a certain period of time, he was able to just stop with mental control. He just decided that he was not going to go any further down the scale of alcoholism. But what happened was, after he retired, he came to the conclusion that, well, you know, I've been successful, I've achieved a lot of my goals. I think what I'll do now is, it's been a long time since I had any problem with alcohol. I'm sure that whatever problem that was, I've outgrown it, or I've gotten better from it, or whatever. And he started drinking again. And what happened was, because alcoholism is progressive, this is a great example of that, because alcoholism is progressive, it always gets worse, it never gets better, especially the physical craving part of it. When he picked back up, he wasn't where he was when he left off, and he wasn't a healthy drinker like he was hoping. He got caught by the progression, and he was dead very, very quickly. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could therefore drink normally. And that's really been disproved over and over again, and especially in my own experience. I quit drinking for 3 months one time. That was before I bought that bottle of vodka. And I'll tell you what, it was much worse when I started drinking again than it ever had been. It definitely gets bad. To be gravely effective, one does not necessarily have to drink a long time, nor take the quantities some of us have. So that's not really, that doesn't really mean anything. Anyway, I'm more alcoholic than a lot of people that could drink me under the table. You know what I mean? My alcohol consumption, at one sitting, I never really could get past about a quart of hard liquor. And there are people that I know that aren't even alcoholic that could drink 2 quarts. That doesn't mean anything, really. And it also doesn't mean how long. I'll give you an example of the first time I ever drank. I cut school with a couple of my friends, and we decided to go back to my mother's house, play hooky, and take a bottle of Four Roses whiskey off the shelf. And what happened was, the two guys I was drinking with, I'm about 12 or 13 years old, the two guys I'm drinking with had about half a glass. I poured out three water glasses of warm Four Roses whiskey. These two guys drank about, I don't know, maybe half of their glass, probably got a little nauseous, a little lightheaded, you know, they'd had enough. That's like a normal reaction for a social drinker. Well, what happened with me was, I went into a blackout, I trashed the house, I drank 3 glasses of this stuff, and I woke up in a field. Now, that's an abnormal reaction for alcohol, I'll tell you know what I mean? And that was the way, that was my relationship with alcohol. Here. As we look back, we feel we've gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. We just gave you the test about whether you have the craving for alcohol or not. That's the test where you go ahead and go to the barroom and try to control your drinking. That'll let you know whether the craving happens. This is to let you know whether the obsession happens with you. You know, just try to not drink for a year. Don't go to AA. Don't bother with any spiritual programs of recovery. Just see if you can not drink. Now, almost invariably, if you're alcoholic, you're going to convince yourself that you overreacted with that test. You know, I don't really think I need to do that. How about a month or whatever? And you're going to convince yourself to drink again. So, if you're really alcoholic and very far advanced, there's scant chance of you being able to remain sober anything like a year. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. And we're assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. You know, if you don't want to stop, that makes it very, very difficult for any of this process to take place. I did not run skipping and jumping into my inventory and amends. You know what I mean? I had to have the fire at my butt. And to die of alcoholism was really the fuel that fired me through this step process. I just don't know anybody that is going to live a vigorously spiritual life just because they want to be good. I mean, I don't associate with those type of people. I'm more comfortable with the crazy alcoholic type personality. Let's see.
Keep going on that paragraph. On 34.2, the bottom of that paragraph. It says, yet we found it impossible, this baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. You know, I don't want to drink anymore. It doesn't matter. It absolutely does not matter when it comes to alcoholism. If you've got the craving, after you've picked up a drink, it takes you. You don't have a choice. But even if you put it down, the mental obsession will sit there. I call it the hamster on the wheel. The hamster gets on the wheel, and the next time you drive past the billboard and you see the little droplets dribbling down the side of the glass, or the, well, geez, I've never had a wine cooler, or what is that stuff? It hit me a couple months ago. Oh, Zima. What the hell is Zima? You know? That kind of thing. That hamster will get back on the wheel, and it's enough to keep it going. You know? No matter how great the necessity of the wish, it doesn't matter when it comes to this stuff. And Chris mentioned progression. It comes off of page 30:3, the last sentence. It says, we are convinced that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. That means any considerable period, including sobriety. If you don't believe it, talk to any old-timer that's gone out and drank, and they will confirm that this thing comes on. You are getting sicker and sicker and sicker while you're sitting in AA. What does that mean? It means when I got sober, when I came in, don't drink and go to meetings may have worked for the first week. But that's not enough spirituality. There's not enough depth and weight to keep me sober. At 5 years, don't drink and go to meetings would not work for me. I needed maybe don't drink, go to meetings, and work a couple of steps. At 10 years, that isn't enough to keep me sober because my disease is progressing. You know, at 15 years, I needed to be don't drink, go to meetings, 12 steps, pray and meditate. At 18 years now, I don't drink, go to meetings, 12 steps, do workshops, read spiritual books, read their history, put together workshops, you know, do all that kind of stuff. My spirituality has to grow and grow and grow. Why? Because my progression is growing and growing and growing. If I stop my spiritual progression, my alcoholic progression will nail me. Why? Because it's insidious.
So what sort, this is page 35, paragraph 1, what sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? They're going to give us some experiences. So you might not have to quit drinking to see if your experience confirms that you're alcoholic. Sometimes you can use these examples to identify yourself in this process. The first example is the one called Jim. They talk a little bit about him, and he's having a problem, and he ends up getting put in front of the Alcoholics Anonymous people, and they tell him what they knew of alcoholism and the answer they had found. He made a beginning. A beginning might have been he went to meetings and didn't drink. You know, what was his beginning? He made a beginning. Maybe he did a four-step and didn't follow through with the amends, but he didn't go all the way through. He just made a beginning. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. That's a good resentment right there, you know. I got to work here now. I used to own this place. And, of course, he's going to be telling the boss how to run the place before he lost it due to mismanagement, too, you know, if he's any kind of an alcoholic. He kept getting drunk, though, half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, carefully reviewing what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition, and he knew he didn't want to keep on, but yet he got drunk again. Let's go down to 36.2. I like this squiggly font. It usually means it's a very important idea. He's talking about his last drinking experience. They ask him, well, tell us what happened. I mean, why didn't you know that you shouldn't pick up a drink? Tell us what happened. He goes, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach, you know. Completely nuts. But these are the type of lies that we drink on. We do not tell ourselves the truth. If I was to pick up a drink tomorrow and I was to tell myself the truth about it, I would have to say, well, Chris, you know, you're going to go have a drink. So you need to plan on up again, so I'll lose a driver's license. I'll get deathly ill. I'll go through a horrible period of relapse where I'll practically drink myself to death and I'll end up back in Honesty House. I think I'll take the car down to the liquor store. I mean, nobody is going to drink on a truth like that. So what our minds have to do is they have to fabricate lies. They have to It has to use subtle, cunning, and baffling aspects of our consciousness to convince us to pick up another drink. But alcoholism convinces you to pick up another drink.
And notice the word he used was suddenly. A friend Mark Houston says, you know, we think we know when we're gonna, what our next drink looks like, you know, but how do you defend yourself against suddenly?
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Hey, Chris, suddenly it's going to hit me in 20 minutes. I need you to come over and talk with me. Talk me down from this one so I don't get drunk. There is no defense against that, you know. But why did suddenly hit him? Back on 35:3, the 1, 2, 3, 4th sentence down, look what it says. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. He didn't enlarge his spiritual life, yet the progression kept going until all of a sudden the scales tipped. The progression was heavier than the spiritual life, and boom, he's out drinking. Suddenly comes walking through the door, and he puts whiskey in his milk.
One of the things you hear also in Alcoholics Anonymous all the time is you don't just pick up a drink. The slip happens long before you pick up the drink. And I believe that in one area. I believe that when you let up on your spiritual condition to a certain degree, you're setting yourself up for a slip. But that doesn't mean you consciously know it. That doesn't mean that you're planning on drinking. There's a lot of confusion with relapsing people in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in our area. A lot of times these people are shunned, and they're considered people that are dishonest. They don't have the capacity to be honest with themselves, or they don't have a desire to stop drinking. Many, many things are clipped onto these people. And I just truly believe today that the only reason anyone drinks is because they haven't taken enough of the spiritual exercises that are laid out for us to be able to be placed in a position safe and protected from the first drink. It's as simple as that. You can call it whatever you want, but if you don't enlarge your spiritual condition with work and self-sacrifice for others, which is something a lot of people don't like to hear. If you don't do that, you may be planning your own drink, you know. How is that tied into whether or not you're going to put alcohol in your body again? You know, how do you tie that in your own personal experience?
It's a state of mind. You know, the doctor diagnosed us, the world's preeminent expert in alcoholism, says we cannot differentiate the true from the false. So you are the last person in the world that's ever going to figure it out. Alcoholics lie to themselves better than to anybody in the entire world. You know, we tell ourselves lies and we believe them. Even when other people look at us saying, you're a liar, we believe it. You know?
Page 37, paragraph 3. In some circumstances, we do go out to get deliberately drunk. You know, to hell with AA, to hell with all those people, I hate my sponsor, I'm going to go get drunk. So that's deliberately. But what about suddenly? You know, what about when you convince yourself that it would be a good idea to buy a gallon of vodka so that you can not drink better, like I did? You know what I mean? What about that strange mental blank spot? How do I protect myself against that? You know what I mean? That's deadly. Our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink, as that of an individual, say, with a passion for jaywalking. And here's another example. I won't get too deep into it, but I am the jaywalker.
On page 37, if you scan that page, look what it says. On the first line, it says, the foolish. It's talking about somebody who's foolish. Three lines down, it says, plain insanity. Then he talks about insanely trivial, insanely insufficient, absurd, and incomprehensible. They're talking about the insanity of our disease. So I went back to that old dictionary, and it's in the guide. It's at the top of page 3 of the definitions. And it was kind of interesting. It says, insane, exhibit an unsoundness or derangement of mind. Not sane, mad, deranged, gross folly. It's a miracle, given to unrealistic fantasies. Geez, I've never seen an alcoholic in an unrealistic fantasy. The four principal types of insanity are melancholia, depression of spirits, dejection. How many times do you see somebody in an A meeting just depressed? Mania, excessive excitement or enthusiasm, a craze, a rage or a fervor. Never seen an alcoholic in a rage, not in an AA meeting. Delusional insanity, false belief and misconception. You know, we can't differentiate the true from the false, remember that? And dementia, out of one's mind, mad, to deprive of reason. The most insane thing we ever do in our entire lives, we do to stone cold sober. And that's to pick up another drink, knowing full well what it has always done to us. And we do that sober, in our best thinking. The furthest we've ever been away from our last drink is when we're now sober and we pick up the next one. Whoa. That's when our insanity hits.
So here's this jaywalker. He's like jumping in front of cars and buses and breaking his arms and legs. And everybody's looking at him like he's a complete nutcase. Like they looked at me when, every time I went out and got drunk. I mean, this stuff was killing me, and I continued to keep drinking it. Is the illustration of the jaywalker too ridiculous? I don't think so. I used to think it was ridiculous, but I think it's a wonderful, wonderful identification for alcoholism now. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? When I used to go to second step meetings when I was brand new, I would always be quite disgruntled about them considering me insane. You know, why should God restore me to sanity? I'm one of the smartest people I know. Matter of fact, I'm smarter than most of you people in here. Why in the world would you call me insane? Well, they're not talking about being a psychotic. Well, they might be with some of the people we sponsor. But they're talking about the insanity that precedes the first drink. Remember I told you my story about buying that gallon of vodka? I was completely insane when I bought it. And when I cracked it open, when I started drinking it, I was completely, it was the craziest thing I could have done. It's the jaywalker jumping in front of the bus.
39:1, halfway down that paragraph. It says, but the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly any exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. You can't think your way through this program. This is the point we wish to emphasize and to reemphasize, to smash home upon our alcoholic reader as it has been revealed to us. Do you think you know what your next drink looks like? That's what we need to start asking ourselves. What does our next drink like? I know people that tell me, oh, I know I won't get drunk. I know what my next drink looks like. Maybe if my kids get killed in a car accident, I might consider it, but, you know, going to my boss's graduation, you know, when he's retirement party isn't going to be a bother for me. They think they know what their next drink looks like. They think they know that they're safe. We're given tests in this book on how to tell whether we're going to be safe going through an environment like that. And it's not what we think.
Well, one of the things you hear a lot around our area is, well, my sponsor told me not to pick up a drink even if my ass fell off.
I just don't drink no matter what.
Yeah.
Then what are you doing in an AA meeting? If you got that kind of power, then just go out and don't drink.
You know, alcohol can't possibly be your problem if you know. I mean, what are you doing in AA meetings? It's absolutely true. Fred, let's talk a little bit about Fred. I relate a lot to Fred.
Page 39.
Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm, fine family, attractive personality. He's a stable and well-balanced individual. Yet he's an alcoholic. We saw him in a hospital where he went to recover from a bad case of the jitters, and he was ashamed of it. You know, the thing is, the first time I ended up in a hospital because of DTs, I was very ashamed of it. But you know what? You stop being ashamed. I mean, I've known so many people. A couple of guys I sponsor end up monthly in detoxes. You know what I mean? It's like they know where their bed is. It's really a shame. He decided to make up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that he could not do so in spite of his character or standing. Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. We told him what we knew about alcoholism, kind of what we've been doing here today. He was interested and conceded he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would fix him and keep him sober for the rest of his life. You know, I just want to keep my memory green. How could I possibly pick up another drink knowing how horrible my last drunk was? Just keep remembering your last drunk. Self-knowledge would fix it. You know, thanks for the... Have you ever seen people like that come into AA, they get the crash course, they're around for about a month. Thanks for the information. Thanks for the book. I'll read the book. You know, thanks for telling me first things first, and don't pick up the first drink. I'll catch you. You know, a lot of times if they really are alcoholic, you're going to see them stumbling back in pretty soon. We didn't hear from Fred for a while. One day we were told he was back in the hospital, and he was anxious to see us. The story he told is much most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced that he had stopped drinking and had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, but he was flat on his back nonetheless. One of the reasons that we're spending so much time on the first step here today, and we're harping on this over and over again, on the powerlessness, is because truly, if we can help anyone here today get to a real serious truth about their powerlessness, you know, is it possible that you have this powerlessness in your life today? If we can help people get to that truth, it's going to really help motivate you through the rest of the steps. So many people poop out in the fourth and fifth steps. So many people poop out in the eighth and ninth step. So many people decide not to sponsor, or they don't want to get involved in service work. The deeper the level of truth and understanding that you can get with this material that we're talking about here today, the more motivation you'll have to seek a spiritual experience.
And why do they stop? Because they lose the connection. They've forgotten that that amend that they don't want to bother to finish, they don't realize it has something to do whether they're going to drink again or not. You know, whether you tell that secret you're going to take to the grave, oh, that couldn't have anything whether to do whether I'm going to drink again or not. But that's the stuff that gets it. Those little secrets, those little amends that we refuse to do, that's the stuff that'll nail you.
Absolutely. Page 41, paragraph 1. This is after he relapsed again. He talks about it. He says, as I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner back, like that. Okay, suddenly. You know what I mean? This is a person who has every reason to know. I mean, he's like a lot of us. His life has just been turned upside down by alcohol, and it's, oh, I think I'll have a couple of cocktails. Unbelievable. That was all, nothing more. And down one more paragraph. It says, not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. He didn't think of the consequences at all. That is a scary prospect. I look at that today, and I get shivers down my spine.
But just think the drink through. That'll be your protection. That's what we hear now. Just think the drink through. This guy didn't think. Suddenly hit him, he wasn't thinking. And look at when he drank. Look at 41:0. Physically, he felt fine. Not a problem. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business had come off well. I was pleased, and he knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Does that sound like a guy who's going to go get drunk? He doesn't have any problems in his life.
Hungry, angry, lonely, tired.
It's certainly not hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You know? And boom, he's drinking. You know? We don't know what... If you think you know what your next drink looks like, you are lying to yourself. Let me be the first person to tell you. You have no clue. I know what your first drink looks like only because it will happen when you are not spiritually fit. That's the only precursor we get. Our only reprieve comes from the maintenance of our spiritual condition. If you are spiritually fit, you will not drink. Anytime you are not spiritually fit, flip the coin. It's the grace of God whether you get drunk or not. You have no control, no choice, and you have no idea what it looks like.
And even though his alcoholic friends had told him and prophesied that if he had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come that he would drink again, they said that if I did raise the defense, it would only give way to some trivial reason for having a drink. So basically what happened to this guy is he was given the information that we're giving everybody here today. Don't ever think that what we're telling you here today is going to ensure you from immunity from the first drink. The experience that we lay out, the instruction for the personal experience, can ensure with the help of a higher power immunity from alcohol, but the self-knowledge of it won't. It just did happen, and more. For what I learned about alcoholism did not occur to me when I started drinking. I knew from that moment I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I'd never been able to understand a person who said a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then, and it was a crushing blow. Down paragraph 2. The people that were 12-stepping him outlined the spiritual answer and program of action which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though it had only been a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow, but the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. Pay the money back? You know? Go back to Mrs. McGillicuddy, my second grade teacher, and tell her I'm sorry? It was pretty drastic. But it meant that I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. This was not easy, but the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had a curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be.
Notice on 42:1, two alcoholics came to see him. We're going to come back to that when we start talking about 12-stepping. You always go in pairs.
Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. Please note the word all. That is an incredible promise. All of my problems. I have since been brought to a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I had lived before, and that's true in my case also. Down in paragraph 2. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, a staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to the two of you men whose stories I've heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you are 100% hopeless. So says the medical community. Apart from divine help, had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Also, people like you end up getting resentments after you're about 2 days sober, telling us how to run our hospital, leaving before you should be, not paying your bill, and then coming back in about 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. Heavy words coming from a doctor. Once more, because they tell you everything important in this book at least three times, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
Put that in a question for yourself. Remember, this is a textbook. There's test questions. Do you believe that you are without defense against the first drink? And do you believe that you have lost the power of choice in drink? Every area and aspect about drinking. Over on page 44. 44:1. In the preceding chapters, you've learned something about alcoholism. Well, have you? Have you learned anything about alcoholism? I hope so. But remember, it's knowledge. Let's try to put it into experience. We hope you have made clear distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer. To the one who feels he is atheist or agnostic, such experience seems impossible, but to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he is an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to faith. There's our two choices, door number one or door number two. All right? 44:4. If a mere code of morals, wait a minute, the 12 steps are a mere code of morals, or a better philosophy of life, that's what we hear about all our little cliches, were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. The key word there is we. We could not wish to be moral, we could not wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power was not there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how? We've written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. It means, of course, that we are going to talk about God. Uh-oh. We're going to start talking about God. We must be getting ready for step two, you know. Lack of power. Another word for that is powerlessness. That's what we're talking about. That is our last piece for the step one, the six things we need for step one. We found that we needed to believe in the power of God, was the first one, complete willingness, and honesty, honest desire, as it said in the foreword there, humility to establish and maintain the new order of things. We had to fully concede to our innermost self. And now we have to be powerless over alcohol. Those are the six requirements for step one, if Bill calls them requirements. You know, why are we spending so much time on step one? Because out of 164 pages, Bill spends, here it is, we're up to 53 already, just on step one. You know, we start getting to the upper step. Step six, one paragraph. Step seven, one paragraph. That must mean there's some really important stuff. And if you believe that 12 and 12 is a textbook, it says in the 12 and 12, in under step 6, says the only step we have to have 100% is step 1. It's really important stuff. So it's lunchtime. Let's go have lunch. When we come back, be ready to have some fun, because we're going to jump right through 2, 3, and jump right into inventory. Before we start, we talked all about step 1. We've covered... You on? Okay. We've covered physical... Let's go to the first one, which was with our founder, which is Bill Wilson. Let's go to page 8 in the big book. 8:1. We're talking about the spiritual malady. In Bill's case, he's talking about the spiritual malady he had when he was drinking. And he says, "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master." The depth and despair this guy is putting into words, that's the malady we're talking about. In this case, Bill was drinking when he talked about it. Let's go to page 151. A very apropos number. 151. There's another description, a generic description of a spiritual malady, only this transitions from drinking into sobriety. "For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and the feeling that life is good. But not so with those in the last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we escape the great moments. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and the heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society and from life itself. Shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that his loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out sordid places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily, we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. Now and then, a serious drinker, being dry at the moment, says, 'I don't miss it at all. Feel better, work better, having a better time.' As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half dozen drinks and get away with them. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday, he will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness, as such few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end." This is a guy that comes into AA. He's not willing to do the work. And he, inside, his guts are telling him that he's living the lie. He's not doing the deal, and he knows it. But he's kind of, on the outside, he's wearing the fake mask, you know. He's like, "How you doing, Dave?" "Fine. Got no problems. You know, how's your sobriety?" "Oh, it's great," you know. And inside, he's dying spiritually. "I lived it for years in AA." Let's go to 52:2. This paragraph applies in sobriety and out of sobriety. Most importantly, for people that have been sober for a while, challenge yourself with this. Does this describe you? Because it's one of the best descriptions of the spiritual malady I know. Second sentence on the page says, "We were having trouble with personal relationships." What are they talking about? Personal relationships. Are you having trouble living with yourself? Are you having trouble living in your own skin? Are you having trouble with your workers? Is your boss always the jerk? Is that woman you're married to the problem in your life? You know, if people would just get off the road, you know, those are personal relationships. Are we having trouble with those? "We couldn't control our emotional nature. Are you flying off the handle? Are you coming unglued? Are you shouting at the clerk at the post office? You know, are you yelling at the person in front of you who has 11 items in the 10 only item lane? You know, at the supermarket? Right? We were prey to misery and depression." How many times have you been in a meeting recently when you see somebody that's prey to misery and depression? They come and they share a problem. And the next week they share the same problem. And the next month they share the same problem. And the next year they're still sharing the same problem. You know? They're prey to misery. You know? One of my sponsees who happens to be in this room, I'm not going to mention, you know, I always say when he digs himself a hole, most people want to climb out of the hole. He wants to climb in and decorate. You know, that's where he feels normal. You know, there's a great friend of mine, a great speaker, an AA speaker, and he always talked about being in a cesspool, you know, and the water's right about here, just underneath your nose, and you're watching the turds float by, and that's your life in AA. It's warm, it feels comfortable. All you want is for people to stop making waves, you know. That's all you want, you know. We couldn't make a living, you know. There's more to making a living. It goes back to the same thing. How is your life? What is the quality of your life? It's not just being able to hold a job. Just because you bring home a paycheck doesn't mean you're making a living. Are you living well with the people around you? Are you able to, do you have friends? Do you have people that treat you as a friend, you know? Or do you have people that want to be with you? Or when you walk up, does everybody just kind of scatter, you know? We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not the basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we could see newsreels of lunar flight? The reason I add that last one in there, Bill Wilson was a visionary. He was way ahead of his time. This book was written in 1938. Lunar flight didn't occur until 1968. He was 30 years ahead of his time talking about this stuff. But it's the same basic problem. Whether you're new in sobriety or whether you've been in sobriety for 20 or 30 years, compare your experience. How did your sobriety hold up to this? Are you in the fourth dimension of existence? Are you experiencing utopia? Or is every driver on the road a jerk, particularly if they're ahead of you? You know, are you having problems in every area of your life? Is your boss always wrong and you're always right? I wish I had a dollar for every time I've called somebody and as they're picking up the phone, you hear, "Would you shut the hell up? Hello?" You know? How are you an AA angel and an at-home devil? You know, really, is what I'm talking about. You know, are you practicing the principles of my life? That is the spiritual malady. That is the symptom of the ego rebuilding. The ego is slowly rebuilding, and life isn't the way you want it. You hear it all the time in AA meetings. I want to live life on life's terms, not me. I want to live life on God's terms. My higher power is going to direct me and tell me what to do. And when he does that and I accept that, life is smooth. When life steps the slightest bit outside of their role that I projected onto life, I get upset because they're not doing what I want. And the spiritual malady comes back. And it's part of the first symptom that's going to get the mental obsession. We've got the spiritual malady. To bring it out home, Chris is going to do the wrap-up questions. We're going to put them all in one place and see if you can swallow it.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
It's in your guide on page 3 if you want to follow along.
Try to really get in touch with your own personal experience on these questions. Really
ask yourself this.
Can you or could you control the amount you drink once you start to drink? Now, I know a lot of alcoholics that sometimes they could